Hello, and welcome back to Literally Literary. If this is your first time joining us, be sure to check out our previous episodes. This episode, we are featuring an interview with Kristen Milades-Young discussing her work and debut novel, Subduction.
Well, you know, we first want to thank you, Kristen, for taking the time off your day, and we were glad and really excited to talk about your book. You know, it's a book that, as I mentioned in the first episode, you know, brings up a lot of interesting questions. And so we're fortunate to be able to talk to you here at Literally Literary. You know, we've been doing this for almost 2 years now, and we were talking that you're the first Cuban American writer, but not the first writer who talks about a character who's Cuban American, since we had Running by Natalia Silvestre. But it's a very interesting book because of how you blend in, you know, the social science, the soft science with, you know, the very real drama that goes into these relationships. You know, Peter and Claudia and Maggie, right? The triangle. And so we had, you know, some questions for you that, you know, maybe our listeners might have these same questions, and we hope that, you know, they're able to pick up a copy once you listen to this, or you know, hopefully this kind of gives them that authorial perspective that mm-hmm. they might want. I think, you know, you already hinted at this when you were talking a little bit about your background as a writer. And we were talking about this pre-show, and I think we talked about this in the previous episode, part two, which is, you know, you have your background in journalism. And I was telling my colleagues here about that amazing Snowfall article in particular, and the animation, but also just the narrative component, you know. And I myself have always been interested in not an anthropology, but science communication and how you convey, you know, scientific ideas into a mass audience. And part of the thing that we saw in Subduction that Claudia wrestles with is, of course, you know, the nature of truth when it becomes subject, when it becomes, you know, a participant observer. And so we were wondering if you could talk a little bit about the divide between, you know, truth as conveyed through her anthropological lens, as we see in the transcripts, and truth as conveyed in the fiction. And I think Richie was, you know, if you want to clarify this for me, because this is more Richie's question, is, you know, why is it you decided to make this a fictional story, you know, as opposed to the, you know, telling it in non-fictional lens?
Well, okay, so that's a great question. One of the things I want to do before we begin is talk a little bit about the difference between my journalistic background and then anthropology as a practice, because I think it's important. As a journalist, for example, when someone gives an interview to a journalist, they literally give the interview to the journalist. That becomes something that the journalist cites from. That journalist is not expected to provide a transcript or the recordings to the person who gave them or shared their knowledge with them. In anthropology, so it really is a gift, you know, and it's an offering, and it's a tremendously vulnerable and brave thing to do, to be interviewed by journalists. So I, you know, in this past year of being on tour for my book, I have been interviewed many times, and I have often reflected upon my prior, you know, two decades of journalism and how much people were risking of themselves to show up, right? And knowing that, you know, in an article, you know, that's measured by column inches, most quotes do not extend past two or three sentences. And yet people speak in entire paragraphs, right? So we know that that selective portrayal in a journalistic article can be used to pivot the article towards or away from the intention of the person who was giving the interview. And we know that that even the arrangement of facts is a subjective practice, right? Even if they are all factually accurate. And so the objective lens that journalism operates under was an imposition, I think, to gain authority for institutional overseers like newspapers, or in this case, our particular moment right now, when you're acting as a journalist and I'm acting as the interview subject for the framework of the podcast. Now, and I wouldn't expect you to give me a transcript of this interview. I have not asked that of anyone who has interviewed me. And yet, so that's the journalistic practice. And I think that there's a lot to be said for reforming that so that the community has more engagement with the process rather than that kind of extractive, even if it's not meant to be an extraction, it becomes an extraction of knowledge for packaging for a larger, different audience. And that's often, of course, part of the reason why interview subjects are willing to be interviewed is because they want their ideas to reach a wider audience, and they're willing to risk what it might mean to be portrayed in an unflattering light, right? So in anthropological practices, I think that what the there has been a lot of damage done through the colonial endeavor that basically took knowledge or took a portrayal of knowledge and made it stand in for the reality of a community. And the reality of a community is never monolithic, right? Communities are very multivalenced. They are diverse. There's just so much richness within a community that is very hard to portray through a document. But when an anthropologist goes into a community, now there is co-creation of data, right? There are participatory research is something that is continuously evolving and expanding as a field. And many Indigenous scholars are demanding, rightfully so, that the community have engagement with all parts of that process, including having ownership, co-ownership of the transcripts and the recordings that are created through the process of the interviews. Right. And so that's a very, it's a subtle shift, but it's a very important shift. Look, when you move from looking at a journalism background to looking at the field of anthropology, which is the subject of this novel. Now, for me, there are many wonderful books that are about the Macaw Nation. And one of them that I would highly recommend, for example, is by a Snohomish scholar named Joshua Reed, called The Sea is My Country, The Maritime World of the Macaw. And actually, I venerate that book so highly that I made sure to cite him in the text because I wanted people, I know it's in the acknowledgments, but I don't expect everyone to read the acknowledgments. I want people to move toward that text for a collaboratively created, fascinating portrayal of the long-term activism and ownership of the Macaw for the sea as a territory, right? And when reservations were created through the extractive and coercive process of treaty signings, when that the title of his book comes from a quote from a chief whose name has been kind of changed into Tatoosh, or Sekaoutul, I'm sorry that I don't have the glottal stops and whatnot that Macaw use when speaking their language. But he said, I want the sea, that is my country. And so the entire terms of the treaty were misshapen, right? And even though that treaty gave the Macaw ongoing rights to their usual and accustomed fishing and hunting territories, subsequent laws like the Marine Mammal Protection Act have constrained them from practicing the whale hunting, which is a traditional cultural activity for them that brings a lot of unity and sustenance, both spiritual and physical, to their community. So there are really wonderful nonfiction books that are written by Indigenous scholars which are based on that territory. Another one, for example, is by Charlotte Côté. She's Nuchanal, and she wrote a book called The Spirits of My Whaling Ancestors. Now, her family was from Vancouver Island, and the Nuchanal and the Macaw like kind of live right across the strait from each other. And even though, you know, subsequent settler colonial states put a you know, a border between Canada and the United States, you know, they would just paddle over. It wasn't, that was a false, you know, disconnection. They, in many ways, their language families actually are the same. And that is, really, it's called the Lower Wakashan dialect. And that is very different, from like Makar, like a linguistic isolate, within, Washington state. And that's really interesting when you consider what it means for cultural, engagement and intermarriage and all of that. And so there are really wonderful nonfiction texts, right, that are dealing with some of the issues that my book touches upon, but does not dwell upon. For me, what I found really fascinating, I grew up in Florida, right? That's where my family settled after they left Cuba and under duress, right? And so the Native presence in Florida is very, very real. And there are, you know, numerous tribes that are, who have ongoing political engagements, and there are many more that have, you know, not been recognized or have been erased through the process of colonization. In the Pacific Northwest, particularly in Washington state, the presence, the political presence of tribes is ongoing. It is powerful. It is visible. And I think it asks for every single person who moves to this place or who is raised in this place to consider what is their complicity in the erasure or engagement of these communities and their needs. Many people, I think, do not recognize the extent to which indigenous communities of the Pacific Northwest have helped create an ongoing environmental movement, that they use scarce resources to protect legal resources, to protect rivers and watersheds and all kinds of territories in a way that benefits everyone and yet goes unrecognized, right? And so, you know, I was always raised with this idea that, you know, we were immigrants and we had done this amazing thing. My family had to leave Spain under Franco. And there's various sides of my Cuban family, right? But one side of them, so one of them is from Cuba and, you know, goes way back there. And one of them is from Spain. We had to leave Spain under Franco. That was hellish, right? We had to leave Cuba under Castro. That was hellish. We had to start over so many times. And so coming to the United States, it was a very positive narrative, right? We made it. We worked so hard. We faced prejudice. We lost everything. We started again. We started below where we had been, right? And that takes a lot of doing, right? Psychologically and emotionally as a family, to decide to be less than you had been, be considered to be less than you had been, and work your way through that, you know, and the hope that your children will be able to, you know, ascend, if that thing is possible in American culture anymore, and have an education, you know? And so, but the fact is that every single person who arrives in the United States becomes a settler, and that includes people of color. And most immigrants do not consider themselves to be settlers, but they are. We are. And so I wrote a fictional book that explored through this interdynamic process, these three people, what it means to realize, recognize, and then hopefully enact some kind of responsibility toward the communities which preceded us here. And although it's very true that that could have been done in a nonfiction way, I feel like nonfiction, which pretends to depict the interiority of people who are interviewed, is intrusive in a way that, because it pretends a singularity of thought when thoughts are really complicated and they go in all different directions. And so because of that, you know, the interior emotional landscapes of these characters is as important to me, or more important to me, than what they say to each other. In fact, most of what the book is about is what they don't say to each other, right? Yeah. They live in these permanent states of non-disclosure, which is true of most people. Most people harbor their damage and never share. And so, and they are permanently afflicted by that, right? Mm-hmm. In ways that are hard to see, because achievement tends to kind of obscure the ways that people are harboring traumas from their past life. Mm. And by that, I don't mean like, you know, before they were born. I mean, but it's the life that they've had from the time they were born to the current moment. And it's also a book that's really about grappling with whiteness, right? Because Claudia, the one of the protagonists, she has decided to assimilate in order to find a place in this country, right? And she has gone, she's done everything that she was taught that she should do, you know, and is left feeling hollow, right? And similarly, Peter, leaving his community after a very traumatic event, you know, he has gone on the road disconnected from his culture, except through the tether of his heart and mind and experiences in his past. You know, he is also left restless, yearning, dissatisfied, unfulfilled, right? And so, and both of that, both of these characters are basically in extended diaspora, right? And so how do you portray people coming together, damaged people coming together, and trying to find a way into true engagement without depicting their interiorities? Mm-hmm. For that reason, I chose fiction.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. To that point, I'm also just thinking now from that standpoint as writing fiction. At what point in the process did you decide you were going to share both points of view? Or was that always the plan?
It was always the plan. For me to have a book set in Indigenous territory that does not feature an Indigenous person as a protagonist in both thought and action is akin to having a movie that involves Indigenous characters that don't have any speaking lines. So even though it made me paranoid, and even though it made me very worried, and I spent a full decade researching the book, going out so many times back to Nia Bay, starting friendships that continue to this day, right? People that I host at my home, people who host me in their home. Like the true reward of this process has been my engagement with some members of that community, and not, you know, the virtual tour, you know, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, even though I knew that it goes against the dogma of literature at this time, which is that one should write from basically an autobiographical perspective at all times, I felt it was important for this book, and particularly a book that is looking at the effects of the settler colonial state on the psyche, and that the effect of the settler colonial state on intimate relationships, and the effect of the settler colonial state on the production of scholarship, that it was important that both characters come in fully, both their emotions, their thoughts, and especially because Peter, I mean, he's sexist, he's surly, right? He thinks he's right all the time. There's a lot of things going on with him as a character, and he's also very tender, right? He's also someone who yearns for love, right? And is not always able to show up for it when it happens, which makes, of course, what unfurls in the book more affecting in my mind. And, you know, to the extent that it's possible, I really gave myself over to this process of researching and listening and interviewing and trying to get it right, knowing how much I was risking, right? But also knowing that what most people do is fail to engage, right? And that failure to engage is a bigger problem in my mind. It is the largest problem that we have as a society, that we are balkanizing ourselves and we are polarizing and we are failing to listen to each other. And so the process of making this book was one of deep listening, and that I did decide, right at the beginning, you know, that it was going to be Peter and Claudia. Although at one point I was considering Maggie as well. And there's of course she's suffering from dementia, and, you know, she goes in and out of this like incredible lucidity, right? And then she kind of recedes again. And it's kind of this tidal ebb and flow of memory, which would have been beautiful, I think, on the page. But I also wanted to keep pressure on the central metaphor of the book, which is subduction. And so out of that, I decided to feature Peter and Claudia.
It makes a lot of sense, Kristen. And, you know, you said a lot of things that I think, you know, a couple things in particular that I think we already have planned to ask you about. But, you know, you said a lot of interesting things nevertheless. But keeping it with what we had here, Vanessa had a question about that. You know, you mentioned about your research. You know, you mentioned you did it about a decade's research. And so you can ask it if you want.
Okay. I was just curious about like, what was your favorite part of this research? And like, what you found the most difficult to also include in the text as well.
Thanks. My favorite part of the research was when, after I had kids and I was bringing my family out there, the Macaw Nation, just like Latinos, you know, they are very family oriented. And, you know, to be there as a woman alone was very different than to be there with my children. And because, you know, if I were doing research for an investigation, I would never bring my children along, right? That's mm-hmm. just not something that I would do. I would go, I would be, you know, professional. I would, you know, break out, you know, the notebooks and everything. And even though every single time, I was always very upfront about what I was doing there, why I was there, you know, what my project was, who I was, I found that to be an ethical requirement of doing this, you know, and so watching Macaw tribal members interact with my children, attending, you know, potlatches with them, and, you know, having my children bear witness to a cultural and family event, you know, for them to see that Indigenous culture is so alive, right? Growing, right? Because there's so many families out there, so many kids, right? It's and so them to see this community as this vibrant, thriving community that it is, despite the issues that are attendant to any Indigenous community trying to survive the settler colonial state, right? That to me was my favorite part of the research process, is watching their awakening into this knowledge that didn't come from a book. It came from being there. I think probably the hardest part for me was just maybe just getting started, right? I did a lot of reading at first. I read everything that Macaw tribal members had written about themselves. A tremendous amount of scholarship came out from the Ozette Dig. And for your listeners who may not be aware, the Macaw territory extends to far beyond these, but there are five ancestral villages, one of which is called Ozette. And the longhouse, which is on the beach on the Pacific, and the longhouses at Ozette were buried in a landslide that I believe was triggered by an earthquake hundreds of years ago. And they contain archives that go back, archival materials like nets, baskets, you know, all kinds of weaponry, fishing implements, right? And it's been called the American Pompeii because the anaerobic environment of the saltwater beach preserved them to the extent that, you know, one of the erasures that often happens from in America and other places that predicate written representation over oral history in history making, is that many of the technologies that Indigenous peoples became masters of are based with biodegradable, you know, materials. And so, you know, one of the nets that was, during the Supreme Court case that was about tribal fishing rights and the how much of the fishing like allotment should go to tribes, a net that had been found at Ozette and preserved through this combined project between Doc Doherty, who's an archaeologist, and the Macaw tribe, and whose artifacts are now portrayed and in replica at the Macaw Culture and Research Center, because they have the good stuff like in air conditioning, like under, like, you know, in darkness to preserve them for future generations. Like, it's like a really long-term thinking that the tribe is constantly invested in. That net actually helped prove the existence of that technology. And had a material impact on how many fish and like how, whether fishing families, the tribal fishing families can sustain their families and their tribe with their socioeconomic activity. Right. And so the history of this people is both preserved in oral form and also they are somewhat fortunate as compared to some other tribes to have this amazing, amazing repository of items. You know, one of them is like a it's called a whale saddle, and it's a carved wooden saddle that is supposed to, you know, and it has lines and lines of otter teeth put into it, and it's just, I mean, it's beautiful, right? And to see that And a lot of the other implements, you know, fishing line sinkers and things like that, there'd be carvings on them. And so the, to see these functional items that also had this, you know, spiritual and artistic relevance to them is just amazing. And so, you know, to the extent that you can, the Macaw Nation's not open right now because of the, because of COVID. But if y'all ever get out to Nia Bay, go check out the Macaw Cultural and Research Center. It's indigenous run. The board president, Mayor Parker, the executive director, Janine Ledford, they're Macaw, right? It's Macaw run, and it is world-class place for learning about their culture. And it's one of the ways that they welcome, you know, outsiders to come engage is through this curated space that also does a lot of work with dances and songs and that are presented annually through the Macaw Days, which happens in August typically, which is like the best, it's they quote unquote the best time to go there because it's, you know, sunny and a little bit warmer. And usually it's kind of like pounding rain out there, but or misty, you know, but it's really, it's a beautiful, beautiful experience. And I highly recommend if y'all ever get out to Washington State to. And they also have like Shy Shy Beach, which is out there, which is like this, the world, people who are doing like top 10 beaches always put Shy Shy out there because these gorgeous sea stacks, right? And just the natural environment there and the cultural richness that they have preserved and sustained and continue to develop or something that I think is a cultural treasure, really.
Thank you. And you know what, in you mentioned your acknowledgements as well. And, you know, you were saying right now, a lot of the Macaw that you were thanking there and a lot of the Macaw that, of course, you know, you interacted with and pre-show, you know, because we always have a pre-show where we kind of talk about some of these things. And we were talking about, you know, what if you've, you know, given the understanding that, you know, online things are much more difficult, but, you know, if you've heard anything about the reception of your work within that Macaw community, you know, that goes to show what they think about your work in terms of, you know, how you grapple with those ideas of, you know, the settler colonial state and Peter's own struggles as well of, you know, fitting in.
You know, it's hard to say like what a community thinks, right? Because to say that is to make a monolith out of what is in fact a collection of families, you know, thousands of people, right? So I don't want to, in the statements that I'm going to give that follow, to say, because this person said it was good, or this person shared it on Facebook, or this person showed up to my book, you know, launch, or this person bought 3 copies for her daughter, you know, that there isn't going to be a tribal member who finds fault with the depictions or is perturbed by the story, right? So I want to say that right off the bat. However, I have been extremely grateful, you know, when the book was named a finalist for International Latino Book Awards, my friend Joe McGimsey shared that news on Facebook. That meant a lot to me, you know, it meant a lot to me. I mean, he's hosted me in his home. He's hosted my children. He's come to my home. But the fact that he was willing to stand with me at that moment was like probably one of the most meaningful things that's happened for me. All the other stuff is just window dressing. This is the real thing, right? Mayor Parker, who was the board president of the Macaw Cultural Research Center, she, you know, posted in the discussion board for the Facebook launch that was through Hugo House. That meant a lot to me. You know, she said that she wished she could take one of my classes. That meant a lot to me, right? And so I think that they saw that I wasn't just in there for 3 months and then left, right? I started going out there in 2004, right? And that's a pretty big difference between a lot of scholars and writers who are interested in a community, but whose engagement ends at the moment that their research process ends, right? To me, I think that that's one of the reasons why, you know, I still, you know, Janine Ledford, like I said, the executive director of Macaw Cultural Research Center, she hosted my family for Macaw Days and we camped out on her property, you know, and it was beautiful. And you know, I think also it's helpful that I do not feel Makaw have suffered suffered a global siege for their whaling rights. Right. So any reticence or hesitance they would have about engaging with people who are outside of the community is very well founded, because a lot of supposed progressives were really anti-Indigenous treaty rights throughout that process in their defense of the gray whale. Right. And so any reticence or anger or suspicion that anyone would have is completely founded in history. Right. And is ongoing. So in a lot of ways, the books, one of the anthropological or the historical features of the book is the history of the anthropological gaffes that have happened that have been so damaging. For example, one of the first Indian agents, as they were called then, James Swan, ransacking graves for the heads of chiefs that he sent to the Smithsonian, right? That they were required to return those desecrated remains so that they could be repatriated and honored in the way they should have been, right? So after you have, as a community, have experienced that kind of desecration, any kind of suspicion, anger, or even, for example, just rejecting the idea of something without having read it or really engaged with it, to me is completely founded, and I would not be offended, right? But up until this point, people have been very generous and welcoming. And that's actually something the Makaw are really known for. Their name, so their self-given name is Kwidichach, which means like people of the Cape, people of the Gulls. And Makaw as a term is a Klallam term for what is people like, generous with food. So literally you cannot, like when you go to someone's house, you are going to eat, right? And you're probably going home with some like frozen fish. Right. Or smoked fish. And so that's an element of their culture, which I find so beautiful and which is sadly lacking in a lot of communities. I can't imagine if I went to another small town and just started, you asked me what was the hardest part about the research, was just showing up and hanging out for hours without knowing anyone. Right. Now, luckily in some ways, there are like venues for doing that. Right. My friend Lila Parton has a fry bread stand. And I would hang out and talk and just chit chat. And that in and of itself, you know, I think one of the features of quote unquote mainstream American culture is that people are like so efficient that they're brutal, right? They don't even say hello or goodbye or thank you or anything. It's just like, you know, very transactional. And so just being willing to hang out and listen and talk and answer questions honestly and just be myself, that was, you know, ultimately at first the most challenging, because of course I had always been a journalist asking questions, right? And not being asked questions, although I would answer them when I was asked, to really just showing up saying, hey, this is me showing up as a full person. And I'm very grateful for the welcome, and people brought me into their homes. People at one point when the PI closed, I was used to be a staff reporter for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. When the PI closed, I moved out there for a couple months. And the people, there's a schoolhouse attached to, you know, that's kind of across the street from the clinic. And, you know, people gave me the keys to that and let me stay there, you know, because like a lot of times, you know, homes are kind of full, right? There are people already living there, cousins and children and, you know, and so, I mean, they made a space for me. It's something that I challenge myself to do, that if I ever encounter someone who comes with curiosity into my neighborhood or my community, to make the time for them, right? The way that it was made for me. And in that way, they led. That's the kind of cultural leadership that I think that more people should be looking to Indigenous communities to emulate, because it's real and it's ongoing and it's something that's beautiful and too often not even seen as a possibility within other communities.
That's great to hear, Kristen, you know, and we talked about it, you know, a little more in the episode that's going to be out soon. We just have one more question, and then we will end it with just a question that lets you maybe talk a little bit about some of your upcoming projects. Our last question actually takes us to the beginning. And, you know, we talked about your epigraphs quite a bit. You already referenced, and we've talked about, you know, Claudia's desire to assimilate and, you know, she's identified as a white woman, you know, and then she kind of counters that with Latinx. And, you know, we talked in the show about how, of course, there's white Latinx, right? Just like there's black Latinx. So just being Latinx does not itself mean that you're minoritized necessarily. So that specifically this question is about, you know, you have the epigraph from Wilson Duff, and of course you share that very interesting story of his, and it's in a scene where, you know, we talk quite a bit about where, you know, she already has in mind, how can I appropriate this artifact, right? So that I can produce some kind of scholarly material for it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the epigraph, you know, is from Wilson Duff, and we talked about even like the ordering, if that was also something you were thinking, if that epigraph you also think encapsulates the Baldwin one, or, you know, basically the reason why that epigraph, very interesting epigraph, thinking about the mask and the mirror, right, which I think goes into the heart of anthropology. But we were just wondering about how you see that within Claudia's perspective, you know, because I'm surely she imagines herself as someone who is not going to prey on this community, of course, right? And she's very conscious of that. In the transcripts, we see that process. But yeah, just in regard to that epigraph, in terms of whether you think, how does that play into encapsulating the novel and Claudia's story?
Well, first of all, I mean, Claudia butchers that transcript, right? What she does is deeply unethical and wrong. She erases the tracks of the mistake that she made in the conversation in order to try to manipulate the outcome of what the people will do when they receive that transcript. That is unequivocally wrong. And I hope that any person who reads that scene has a deep nausea, right? A deep nausea, because that I wrote this book to perturb, right? Mm-hmm. This is not a feel-good book. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's a book you have to think your way through these characters because they don't act right. She's not doing what's right, you know? The way that she, and even though she's harboring a lot of trauma, and Peter as well, I mean, what he does to her, right? I don't care how he cloaks it to himself. What happens between them is deeply human, and so it is deeply flawed, right? So there's two epigraphs. The James Baldwin, which comes from Ordinary People, a really beautiful photo essay that was done with Richard Avedon. And it's hard to find in print, actually. So I had to actually go to the special collections of the library. It's also very expensive. And so, you know, I'm like, oh, I want this, but it's $100. Oh, gosh. But they have this at the special collections at the Seattle Public Library.
Yeah, we were wondering where it was from. I went to go fact check it there.
Yeah, so it's from Ordinary People, and it is a really beautiful book, and I highly recommend it. There was a press did make a reprint of it, but then that ran out immediately, so it's still hard to find. And then the Wilson Duff epigraph, which, so actually for the listeners, I do want to take a moment to read them both, because it's a good question, and I think that their interplay is something that I would like for you to, the sound you hear of me getting into my book pile, excuse me.
Yes, go for it.
The Wilson Duff is first and the Baldwin is second. Duff, in the one hand, you are holding the mirror. On the other hand, you are the mask. Put on the mask and look in the mirror. That's an excerpt from a poem that he wrote. And then the Baldwin is, for nothing is fixed forever and forever and forever. It is not fixed. The earth is always shifting. The light is always changing. The sea does not cease to grind down rock. Generations do not cease to be born, and we are responsible to them because we are the only witnesses they have. The sea rises. The light fails. Lovers cling to each other, and children cling to us. The moment we cease to hold each other, the moment we break faith with one another, the sea engulfs us, and the light goes out. So, to me, the Duff question introduces the idea of positionality, self-representation, right? And whether it is possible in this framework to engage truly and fully with another human being. So that's part of the reason. And whether it's even if that human being is yourself, right? Because the first person that Claudia is cruel towards is herself, right? And that cruelty that she, at one point in the early chapters, you know, she is talking about how she began speaking to her husband with all the cruelty of someone who does not expect to be overheard, because that's how she talks to herself, right? And usually when you hear people who are very unkind to other people, it's because that's how they treat themselves, right? So she, if you are not in connection with the self, how can you show up for somebody else, right? That's Claudia's issue. Now, with the Baldwin quote, part of the reason that I felt it was important to include, there's of course so much of the sea and the rock and everything, but this idea of intergenerationality and the this is an ongoing concern. This is an ongoing problem. It's an ongoing opportunity, right? So just relinquishing our complicity, relinquishing our responsibility to others, and acting as though we have nothing to do with these communities, or even with the communities from which we ourselves have moved into diaspora, right? That's when he's talking about, that's breaking faith, right? That's how I interpret that. And so the ongoing opportunity is to try to act and be differently in the world. And I can say that for myself, I don't know what will happen for readers, you know, who read this text. I hope that they will think more deeply about their own positionality within this culture, this miscegenated, multivalenced, you know, mess of American culture that we're in, right? Because these people are all Americans, right? As well. They're macaw, she's Latina, but she's also, this is an American novel, right? And it's a deeply American novel because it gets at the origin story of our country, which is a collision of diaspora and indigeneity, right? People want to erase that origin story. They don't want to be held responsible, even though, I mean, gosh, I was just, I did an essay collection called Seismic, where I interviewed Ken Workman, who's the great, 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 great grandson of Chief Seattle, right? He's here. He was a Boeing engineer, right? They're here. They're ongoing. Even though the Duwamish have not been given the federal recognition that they were promised and that they deserve, they are here. And so recognizing, honoring their presence, understanding that honoring their presence might mean accepting things about our own complicity that we do not wish to accept, having been told the positive immigrant narrative that most of us were schooled in, whether or not we're people of color or white, you know, that is something that I feel is an ongoing project. And so for me, the legacy of doing this book and the decades that I spent on it is that I have more deeply engaged with Indigenous issues as an investigative reporter for The Guardian. I spent a year of my life investigating the death and disappearance of Misty Upham, a really wonderful Blackfeet actress who was found, whose body was found in the woods in Auburn, and the police did not search for her. And she was found by her family. And so I spent a long time telling the story of that community resilience in the face of institutional disregard and lack of care. I have worked with, to the extent that I can, in my own projects, like with the Seismic Collection, which is a reflection about what it means for Seattle to be a city of literature. That collection opened and closed with Native voices because those voices have been here for millennia. And they need to not only be part of the conversation, they need to be guiding the conversation, right? As a mentor, I have worked with Indigenous writers who I expect and I hope will eclipse me immediately, right? Immediately. And that's the thing about the Baldwin quote. Generations do not cease to be born. There is possibility for healing here, but it's only going to happen if we think very deeply about where we've been. And even though this comes from a different Baldwin essay, the essay on the creative process, which I would highly recommend to all of you and to your listeners, the price of the freedom that was promised by America is a long look backwards, okay, so that we can create something that is better for the future. And to the extent that literature can serve that purpose, to the extent that literature serves a purpose at all, rather than reaching into people's hearts and making them feel something, it is my hope that my novel will serve to ask people to more deeply engage with the communities that they have joined by coming to the United States or being born here.
That's a great answer, Kristen. Thank you. You know, we can't wait to share this with our listeners and also share the other two episodes where we, you know, go into the nitty gritty of your work and how it does grapple with a lot of these ideas that you discuss, you know, and also, you know, have it in mind in our 21st century of what it is that we do with the novel, you know, and I know that, you know, because of the pandemic last year, you know, that you weren't able to have that, you know, book tour, but in that regard for our listeners, you had just posted, I think, I don't know if it was this morning or sometime yesterday about, you know, you're taking a hiatus to work on something. And I was wondering if you wanted to tell listeners about what it is they can expect. I mean, I know, you know, this took a long time to write, but if there's something that our listeners should know about you as far as where they can find your work, your upcoming work, your upcoming events, that sort of thing.
Thanks. So I want to talk a second about dismantling whiteness, right? Which is a necessary project. To do that, I just want to say, I think that your podcast is part of that project, because a friend of mine, an author named Alyssa Washuda, who's Cowlitz, and wrote a book called White Magic, which is an excellent, excellent essay collection from Tin House. She said, and I find it so true, that whiteness is not a phenotype. It's a way of relating, right? So what you were doing, building the canon, creating avenues for people to encounter new ideas, and to encounter those ideas in a critical way, I think is something that's of true service. And I'm really grateful that you've included me in this project. So thank you. I'm an essayist, and I have three essays coming out. One is in Pank magazine called Father's Day. One of them is in The Rumpus called This Is Not a Metaphor. And one of them is in the Compassion issue of Fiction International, but it's also an essay called Our Lady of Perpetual Self-Loathing. So those are kind of parceling out. And because they're literary reviews, I don't have a, you know, exact pub date, but those will be coming up soon. And I am on hiatus from social media to finish another book length project called Great Mother, which is a hybrid text that looks at a pagan mother goddess cult that was the precursor for Christianity, and whose relationships, kind of the sexless, deathless relationship between the gods, which is very unusual in the Roman pantheons of gods, because all the Roman gods were very fertile. They had sex with everything they saw, you know, like it didn't matter if it was family member, animal, you know, mortal, god, whatever it was. So this particular cult was acted as a precursor to Christianity and kind of paved the way for Christianity's spread throughout the Roman Empire. So that's a fictional element. And then it's this text, I am bringing in nonfiction within these kind of interstitial memoir chapters that show me, you know, my two small kids in tow, researching the history of this cult through archaeological sites in Spain. So that's called Great Mother. It's still in deep production mode, nowhere close to being ready. So if anyone wants to read my other work, I guess you can also see my website, kristinmyoung.com. I'll be putting the essays up there when they come out. But otherwise, the internets. So thank you. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Kristen. And I'm glad, you know, we were able to finally, you know, get this done. And, you know, thank you for your comments about the podcast too. I think, you know, we didn't intend it that way, but I think, you know, given our backgrounds and, you know, our activism as well, that's more or less what we try to do, you know, in our teaching and with this podcast, now that we're, you know, attached to this other group called Border Senses that is kind of rooted in border journalism and border activism. So I'll let my colleagues, you know, because I kind of dominated the airwave here, if they want to share anything else with you.
I just want to say thank you so much for talking to us. And I really enjoyed listening to what you had to say about everything.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Yeah, thank you as well. Thank you.
Yes. And good luck on, you know, working on that. It sounds really fascinating the way that you described the synopsis for it. And it sounds like a lot, you know, and having that be kind of this sounds like a postmodern novel, you know, so we're really excited to hear that. And your book, you know, really got made us want to go there, you know, Nia Bay, and learn more about, you know, the macaw culture and macaw tribe.
They are global leaders, really. And the kinds of interactions that they do with other indigenous communities around the world is a model for community engagement. So I'm glad that you're going to be looking into their doings, which are many. And I look forward to listening to your other podcasts as well. So thanks. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Literally Literary, brought to you by Border Census and Power at the Pass. This episode, we were able to interview Kristen Milades-Young about her debut novel, Subduction. If you haven't read it, we hope we inspire you to pick up a copy. Follow us on Instagram at literallyliterary.ep and on Twitter at literallylitep.